Digital photography has really given us a lot of different options, hasn't it? Not only can we see the pictures we're taking right away, but can also share them in ways that weren't even possible. Many years ago, we take so many more. I think we were on a trip to Hawaii recently, and my wife took something like 700 photos. And, you know, if we'd been doing that with film, probably would have been maybe 30 or something. Oh, man. Larry Mueller here, by the way. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. Paul Hedges has for many years been the Information Technology Director at Wisconsin Historical Society. His title now is he's the Emerging Technologies Archivist in the Society's Library and Archives Division, and he works on digital and audio visual collections and projects. Also consults with small businesses. He works with nonprofits a lot and churches a lot to help them plan for and manage their websites. Very pleased to have him with us today to offer advice and to answer your questions. And Paul, welcome back. Great to have you with us.
Thanks. Thanks much.
I really appreciate it. You're quite an accomplished photographer. What are the pros and cons of this whole move from digital photography to film?
Oh, wow. You know, I think as you mentioned, the ease of taking more photos has become something that's become quite a challenge. But at the same time, we've seen ways to take better pictures than we used to before. Digital sensors allow us to take better pictures at night. Course, those same sensors allow us to do video. So we've now been able to combine photographs with video at the same time. At the same time, it's, of course, being an archivist, one of the questions I always have when I take photos is, what am I going to do with this stuff once I've taken it, and where am I going to keep it, and how long do I want to keep it? I think the other thing that one of the significant changes is that once we have something in digital form, we have many different ways that we can use those images for different purposes. We can now, of course, share them, social media. We can share albums online, and interestingly enough, we've also seen a whole industry of print, Shutterfly and mm-hmm. other professional businesses that, Walmart, Walgreens, mm-hmm. et cetera, where you can upload your photos to and get instant prints, which is something that you really couldn't do as quickly when you were doing film.
Yeah, so there's lots of really, really... Well, pros for the most part. You know, on the con side, you know, I mentioned my wife took 700, whatever it was, 600, 700. I typically, this last weekend, my daughter's in a competition, so I'm there, and I took probably, I bet I took at least 25 photos, of which I probably would have taken one before, and I just snapped off a whole bunch of them, and you know, and if you don't edit or, you know, go back and sort of pare those down, after a while,
you're going to get a lot.
Yeah.
And that is, I think that is one of the things that we're, no matter what, I think digital has allowed us to become better digital pack rat mm-hmm. people. And it does take some focus and attention to make sure that when you've done that, you've taken pictures on your camera or on your cell phone, which of course increasingly, I think I read a statistic recently that the most popular phone model on various like Flickr, etc., other photo websites is the iPhone or an Android phone. So increasingly people are taking those pictures and sharing them. At the same time, as you said, you're taking pictures of a family event and you're putting them on your computer, and all of a sudden you discover after 6 months that you have maybe 1,000 photos, and maybe a third of those or less are really anything that you'd want to keep.
Yeah. Harold in Superior, you know, has a question in some ways relating here to what we're talking about, I think. So let's go there. Harold, hi.
Well, good morning. I feel so privileged to have somebody with so much expertise in available like this. It's hard to get answers sometimes on the internet. There's almost too many answers and too much to wade through.
Yep.
I'm having a hard time kind of coming up with methodology on organizing my pictures. I've got like family photos, and then I have them in there by years, and but then you got the family videos and so on and so forth, and then there's the software, and I go into Picasa, which I haven't used in recent years very much, so it's learning over all over again, and I'm not crazy about the file management in Picasa, and I'm kind of a software junkie, so I have about, I'll bet you I have more photo programs than you've ever heard of. Owners, one, you know, that's kind of an off the wall, but powerful, I guess. But I'm looking for, you know, I've got so many good ones, it's hard to pick one, you know, but for photo management, you know, processing, but just for filing purposes so you stay organized.
Yeah, it's a good question, and you know, I take the approach that there is the reason why we have so many photo applications is because they all have some similarities, but they all might take a different approach, and very much it's kind of an individual you know, kind of preference of one thing or another. A couple of questions. One is, it sounds like, are you running a Windows machine?
Yeah, unfortunately, Windows 8 at the moment.
Okay, so
one of my computers.
And you're currently storing your files primarily by date.
You know, the biggest one, we take a lot of pictures of the grandkids and that, so we take, you know, family photos is one, and then friends, and then I have a directory for general photos, and then under there I've got, you know, breakdowns of various categories under general that, you know, may not be something I'd be sharing with the family. But
sure. That's very common. I used to do that myself, and just in the last several years, I've moved to a fairly strict date organization, in essence, thinking of it as each year I create a date folder, 2014, for example, and then every time I download my photos from my camera or from my phone, I place those photos into a specific date folder, or you know, professional photographers refer to those maybe as shoots or events. And what that does is it allows for a nice way to organize initially. Then I let the software help me organize things such as who are the people in those photos, what was the name of that event, etc. So it sounds similar to it's one way to do it, but at the same time, I think that you have to do whatever's comfortable with you. So if this is a good way for you to feel comfortable with the way those images are stored, then I think you're fine. One way to think about the software is that the software is going to basically, it's going to catalog those images wherever you place them. And so certainly with Picasa, and especially the newer versions of Picasa, it's not going to move your files. It's going to essentially create an index of where those files are already stored. So no matter where you put those files, once you have Picasa looking at those folders or imported those folders, then you can add extra categories. You can use the software to recategorize it, or in essence, to manage those photos.
Well, that is my question, because once I'm in, say, Picasa, I'm always finding folders that could be merged, deleted, moved here, regrouped,
yeah.
And I think I tend to over-organize things, you know, and I'm just kind of going more to one year, for instance, for the family, and not anything by month or even perhaps by activities.
Yeah. Sure. I think that's the great thing about software is that I tend to separate where I store my files with the software and using the software to organize different ways to see my files. And what I mean by that is that, for example, when you take a digital file, there's information in that file that tells you the day and time when that picture was taken. You don't need to store the file by that date and time. You can put it into a month folder or a year folder if you wanted to. I'd say probably down to a day. But you can then use the software to say, show me all the pictures that I took on this day. Or you can even use the software to say, you know, I used to have an old camera. I'd like to see all the pictures I took on that old camera. That information is typically stored inside the file itself, and the software will pull that information out into its catalog. So you don't need to, you can basically leverage or use that information that's stored in the file that the software ingests or harvests into its catalog to filter and sort for different types of images that are based on certain characteristics. Sometimes that's location. You can use Picasa and other software to select certain images and say, these pictures were taken in this specific geographic location. And then later on say, which pictures did I take in Wisconsin, or which pictures did I take in this other country? And no matter where you've stored those files physically, the software will help you bring it back. So that's why I went to a date organizational structure, because what it allows me to do is when I go on a trip, I can then download my pictures and they're stored by the year and the month and the day. And then when I bring that into my software, I can add extra information to that using the software to find those. I can rate certain pictures that I think are great pictures, or I can easily mark pictures to be deleted.
Yeah.
Which is definitely something I stress is to delete anything that you don't need.
Yeah.
Any other questions on that?
Is there any particular software that you favor?
Over the other?
So I do have a preference. I'll just say now I use Adobe Lightroom. It's a relatively low-cost piece of software. It's about $150. It runs on Windows and Mac. So if you have a dual platform, if you have a Mac laptop and a PC desktop, you can run the software on both. So it also works well because I shoot most of my images in RAW format, which is something I can certainly discuss at some point. But Lightroom does a very good job of managing files as well as helping me to develop those RAW images into final JPEG images.
Yeah, there we go. Harold, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. I think it's a lot of information that most of us could use here as we visit with Paul Hedges, who consults with small businesses, nonprofits, and churches to help them plan and manage their websites. He's also the Emerging Technologies Archivist in the Society's Wisconsin Historical Society's Library and Archives Division. I'm Larry Mueller. Jennifer Dargan, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with Paul Hedges about computers, and you know they can really be a tool for some pretty creative things. Amazing creativity, as a matter of fact. Do-it-yourself projects have surged in popularity in recent years, and while some have picked up knitting needles or planted gardens, others have migrated to community spaces to work on projects involving complex circuitry, infrared sensors, and motors. And producer Elizabeth Deliquist takes us to one such place in Madison in this episode of Wisconsin Life.
where we're standing right now is in our machine shop. So as you might imagine, it's full of machines. We've acquired this stuff from over.
My name is Chris Meyer, and I founded Sector 67 about 2 years ago. Sector 67 is a community workspace, and what that really means is we have tools and equipment and resources and all kinds of things that you can use to build stuff. It's also called a hacker space, so don't think of a hacker as someone who's coming in and sitting in a dark corner of their basement to type in a computer and steal all of your banking information. It's just someone generally who would otherwise be called a creative person. So really we're a space for creative people who are called hackers, who do neat and innovative things. So back here is more of a metalworking area and kind of a carpentry area. We've got a field of Tyrannosaurus rexes, scorpions, praying mantis.
I'm Brendan O'Connor, and I'm a second-year law student at the University of Wisconsin right now. And I actually was done looking for apartments and just came over and stopped in and said hi. And 5 minutes later, I was doing real work while sitting on a disused van bench seat on the floor.
So buried down here is a plastic tray and then a big metal mold, and the metal mold is what's used to go through.
We have a lot of tools and technology here that ordinary people can't have, just due to the cost or the space or zoning requirements, which is always fun. It turns out your neighbors get annoyed if you arc weld in your garage. But there's also, because we have access to certain people and equipment and software, we can do things like, for instance, teach classes on three-dimensional modeling, which, you know, the software we use here costs a normal individual user $8,000 per license. Well, that's not something a normal person can afford for just learning something. Whereas here you can come, you can use the software, you can learn, and you can then create things that haven't existed previously. And then just the mix of people lends itself to doing interesting things kind of all the time.
This stuff's all manufactured sort of a traditional way.
I do security research, but I get insight and information from a guy who programs by day and jumps out of perfectly good airplanes at night, and another guy who seems to have rebuilt half of the building while simultaneously running an IT shop. And so there's always just, you know, for any given question I have, there's always somebody around who can at least point me towards a correct answer. And there's never really a good rule. I came in here wanting to destroy a hard drive in a rapid way for a contest one time. So you'd have to have an entire industrial building's worth of power shorted through a hard drive in order to work. So that's about 100 amps. We can do that. Let's just go out back and we'll see what happens. It's probably good that we didn't actually end up doing that, because I think we might have gotten injured. But there isn't a rule saying, well, you just can't do that. It's always just, well, let's look at the trade-offs, see if there's a better way. But if there's not, yeah, why not short 100 amps through a hard drive?
Interesting, isn't it? Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a collaboration between Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. If you'd like to learn more, visit their website at wisconsinlife.org, and you can find them also on Facebook. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest today, Paul Hedges. We're talking about digital photography, organizing, presenting them, but we can also answer your computer questions if you have some general questions. I'm sure Paul's happy to take a crack at those questions as well. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Jim and Montello, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Hello, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And thank you, Paul, for donating your time for this wonderful experience. I have a hobby. I've photograph microinvertebrates, little protozoans, the wee beasties that Leeuwenhoek kind of got excited about back years and years ago. Mm-hmm. And I do it using a webcam and a trinocular microscope. And where you used to put the old camera on the microscope, I just cobbled together something so I can put a webcam there. And I've been doing this for about 15 years. I have, probably 20 gig worth of pictures and photos. My organization is using File Manager, because the cascading nature of that allows me to put all of my, quote, collection, which is really the photos of my specimens, by kingdom, phylum, class, order, and so on, using the taxonomic classifications. But my problem is when I go to a school, the very nicest way, especially a grade school, to present this sort of material and get the kids interested is show them an array of pictures of these little critters, ask them to choose one, and then I can go into that file immediately and tell them all about it, ask them if they have any other questions. We can see movies, pictures, talk about its way of life, its, you know, how it makes a living, how it moves, how it reproduces, things of that nature. But I need a way of doing that that's going to be kind of foolproof, so when I go to the schools, I don't fumble around and waste time. And also something that where I can go from a like an index pick, or on my computer, I do it with a shortcut, and then the shortcut takes me to the file. But to get all of that information onto some sort of portable device to take into the school, that's where I'm kind of struggling with this. Perhaps Mr. Edges can help me.
Wow, you have an amazing project there. It sounds fascinating. I'm just trying to think here. I would imagine that so part of this is portability. You want to make sure that you can put it onto a laptop and take it with you. I'm assuming also that you can't rely on the internet access. So again, you'd want it to be kind of locally installed on a laptop. Is that correct?
Well, I can put it on a laptop, but then how do I get it big enough the kids can see it? And as far as using the internet, that would be prohibitively expensive for me because the transfer of this much data over the internet, I mean, I've got files that are huge.
Sure.
One of the things you could ask the school itself is if they have smart boards. Because if they have smart boards, you can automatically go to your wherever you want online, and that really helps.
I think the other is if your question is really how to make sure that you can project these images large enough, then if the files are already on your laptop, then asking the school if they have a projector, an LCD or an LED projector, or potentially having your business purchase an LED projector, that would allow you to at least project those images and that video onto a screen instead of. So it sounds like they're looking at your laptop screen. Is that correct?
Bingo! I think you hit the nail on the head because if you were sitting next to me right now, Paul or Larry, and we were both looking at my computer screen, I could do everything I wanted. It's just that I can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Have 30 kids.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. So what I would suggest, is the smart board. If the school has a smart board that you can connect your laptop to, that's great. That is essentially a projector that projects onto a whiteboard. At the same time, a simple LED or LCD projector that will connect to your laptop and project on a wall or a screen, it certainly would meet your needs.
Yeah. Absolutely. Smart boards are wonderful. We have them in our classrooms on campus in my department, and it's wonderful just to be able to go online and everything, not have to bring in any other piece of equipment. I mean, it's all right there.
Yep.
Jim, thank you. Pat in La Crescent, Minnesota, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry and Paul. My question revolves around the old-time glass photos. I work for a historical society here, and we would like to digitally archive those glass photos. Your suggestions?
Mm-hmm. Wow. So I'm going to need to punt on this one and say that if you can provide some of your information to Larry, contact information, I have one or two people at the Wisconsin Historical Society that I could certainly put you in contact with as to the proper way to make sure that those glass photos or glass negatives are scanned without damaging them. It's not something I've done any hands-on work with, but definitely there are people in my organization who have. But definitely it is possible. We have done that kind of work at the Historical Society before. I think the can you describe the kind of the scope of the collection that you're wanting to digitize?
Well, we've had studios make donations, Paul, I mean, they're vast. We just have, I would say, you know, in the thousands of glass photos.
Okay. The other is, I see you're in Minnesota, so the Minnesota Historical Society, they have very capable people there who could provide some information to you. And again, if once we get your contact information, I think we could put you in contact with some people. As far as once you've done the digitizing, I think as a historical institution, you will want to think about first is, what is the resolution or what is the quality of the image that you're going to capture and what you will store that file in. You definitely want to look at file formats, digital file formats. Some are better than others for archiving. We're currently looking using TIFF, T-I-F-F, image formats for our archival storage. And then we use JPEG for delivery. And what I mean by that is we'll keep a TIFF file, which is our master, and then we'll create a JPEG file and maybe upload it to a website or share it with somebody. But you'll want to work out those standards as well. And then, of course, deciding where you're going to store those files and make sure that they're backed up, they're duplicated in multiple places, so some of them on-site and off-site, so that your risk of loss is reduced. You want to make sure that you protect the investment that you made in digitizing those glass plate negatives or positives, kind of doing the right thing there.
Thanks, Pat. Good luck. Thank you. Appreciate your help. We'll put you on hold here, and Jen can get your information. And we'll get back to you then. Thanks again. And we have lots of callers and lots of people. An email from Paul wondered, what media and techniques do you recommend for long-term storage? We've learned that consumer-grade CDs and DVDs rot and that hard drives and thumb drives die and that online storage companies that charge for storage change terms or go out of business. For someone who wants to have those important photos in 5, 10, or 20 years, do you have an approach to recommend?
Unfortunately, I don't have a simple approach. The one thing that we've learned with digital files is that, unlike paper, where we could take a book and we could put it on a shelf, and pretty much as long as the paper was not too acidic, we could assume that that book would be around for 50, 100 years or more. Unfortunately, with digital, it is, as he alluded to, it's not just the media, but it's also the file format. I mentioned earlier that TIFF is our current archival standard. That may change in 5 years as new formats come out. So there are questions about what are we going to do next. But then questions of where we store those files is really more of a question about is finding the most stable format that you have today, the most stable media that you have available today. And then assuming that you're going to migrate or move those files to something new within a period of time before that media is going to die. Yeah. So for example, if you put files on a CD, assume that within 3 to 5 years, you should be copying those files off of that CD and putting it onto something else. So really what you end up doing is, it's not quite what is the what is the media that's going to, that I can put it on where I can forget about it?
Yeah.
And just let it sit there for 50 years. It is really about making sure that you're going back to those digital files and moving them forward so that they can be accessed in the future.
Yeah.
But to be more specifically answer your question, right now there are certain media such as gold CDs, gold DVDs, which have been used, which are a little more stable and they don't rot as quickly. Those are options. The other is to use hard drives and to multiply or replicate those files across multiple hard drives, and to even use a cloud service as an additional place to store it. So one of the strategies we use today is called replication, which is essentially multiple copies of that same file in different places. So in case one of them fails, you have it someplace else.
Yeah. Good tips. Peter in Bayfield, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, yeah, good morning. My question is regarding keyword organization versus direct file management in terms of years and subject and date and location, those sorts of things that you've talked about with people. And I've experimented with Acrobat, and I've experimented even more with Bridge, both Adobe products. And it might be my own using technique, but Bridge, I'm still experimenting with Bridge. You can put into the background data, as you referred to it, or the metadata, keywords. And anyway, you mentioned Lightroom also that I have access to. So what are your opinions about keyword organization?
I think they're critical, actually. If you are looking to keep large amounts of files and want to be able to store them, we all need to store them in a particular folder structure. And as I said earlier, my preference today is to store by year and then typically day or month. And that makes it easy for me to go, oh, yes, I took some pictures at this event back in 2014 in August, and I can quickly go to those files. But let's say I take photos of my kids throughout the year, and I want to find all the pictures maybe of my son. Well, so to do that, I really need to use keywords. I need to any time that one of my children show up in a picture, I would add a keyword to that picture so that I could pull up pictures of my children or use a keyword for a particular event or a particular location. So keywords are essentially a smart way to be able to filter your images and bring them back and to create new, you know, kind of smart collections. Bridge, Bridge and Lightroom, because they're the same company, actually, the capabilities that you find in Bridge for cataloging and keyword tagging images is pretty much identical to what you find in Lightroom. So the key value that Lightroom brings is that so Adobe creates Photoshop and they have Lightroom. Lightroom was originally built as kind of a easier way for photographers to get in and be able to organize their photos, assuming that, you know, photographers are taking thousands of photos a month or even, you know, a week, and being able to easily bring those photos in, catalog them, but also to be able to take photos and do some basic processing, some basic developing, changing the contrast and the color balance and those types of things. Without Lightroom, typically photographers will then use Photoshop, and then they may use Bridge as a way to organize their images and catalog them and keyword tag them, and then they'll open it into Photoshop. So So that's kind of the history of how that came about. Ultimately, today you could use Lightroom, and my understanding is Lightroom will import all of that bridge metadata, those keywords that you already added to those images. So you could use Lightroom and not lose any of that work you've already done.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, iPhoto that we by default use for general storage already by default stores images by year or date and that kind of thing. So, all right. Well,
all right.
I'll investigate Lightroom.
Good. All right.
Paul Hedges, our guest today, as we talk with him about organizing and preserving your digital photos and about those computers and those softwares that we systems that we all have in our homes these days. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at your computer today and talking organizing and preserving digital photos as well with our guest Paul Hedges, who is the Emerging Technologies Archivist in the Wisconsin Historical Society's Library and Archives Division. Great to have him along. Thank you for listening in. Give us a call at 800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Paul in Crane Lake, Minnesota has a question for you. Paul?
Hi. How are you folks doing today?
Great. Thanks for calling.
Yes. I shoot with the Nikon D7000, use Nikon lenses, and have just an amateur shooting in JPEG. But, of course, the camera has great capability, and I want to start shooting in RAW. But then my question becomes, if I'm going to shoot in RAW, what would be the best software for a beginner to start using to convert the RAW and to manipulate the RAW files? I'll sit here and wait for your
answer. And we should probably, there are people who are going to say, now, what the heck is RAW? What do you mean when you're talking about RAW?
Yeah, it's a great question and is something that, one of those other benefits that we've seen with digital cameras. So with RAW, essentially, when a camera takes a picture, there is a sensor. In the past, we used to have film that was behind a lens, and then light would come through, and that film, depending on the aperture of the lens and et cetera, that film, those silver particles on that film would gather light, and it would create a picture. Today, we have sensors, or essentially digital sensors, that are behind those lenses. And so when the light comes through now, that sensor basically captures that light and that color information and stores it. What RAW is essentially every camera, if it's Nikon or Canon, Olympus, every Sony, every camera that is a prosumer type camera allows you to save that file as RAW. And what RAW is it is all of the data that was captured by that sensor. Typically, what a camera does is when it captures all that information on that sensor, it applies some mathematical algorithms to make the best picture it thinks you want based on the exposure, and then creates a JPEG image of that. So when it stores a JPEG, it's actually converting all this RAW data to a JPEG file. What RAW does is it allows it to actually save that RAW data to its own file. Now, there are pros and cons to that. One is that when you have all that RAW data, you actually have the ability to dramatically alter that image when you process that image. You can take an image that maybe is a little too dark, and you can recover some of those dark spaces on that image with a RAW file that you couldn't with a JPEG. But at the same time, RAW images become, because there's more data, those files are often much, much larger. My camera today, a RAW file will be about maybe 25 megabytes, whereas if it saves it to a JPEG, it may be 7 or 8 megabytes. So, yeah. So those are considerations. So ROG provides more flexibility, but it also requires this process, which Paul is asking, which is you have to take that raw file and you essentially have to develop it mm-hmm. or process it to create the JPEG file. And there are different ways to do that.
Yeah.
So the question, Paul, I think you had was essentially, you know, what is the best software to convert from RAW to JPEG or some other file format? You know, again, I'm a Lightroom user, and so Lightroom does work well for that. But I know that there are people who use Aperture by Apple, which will do that. There are there's I think a very good program that's called ACDC. It's actually the letters A, C, and D, and the word C, S-E-E, which is a lower-cost piece of software, but it does a good job of also converting and cataloging images. But it'll convert RAW to JPEG as well. One of the key things to consider when you're using RAW is that you're never replacing the RAW file. So in essence, your storage requirements will go up because you're going to be storing your RAW files, and then you're going to be creating JPEG images to share or print. So in essence, you're going to have two versions and sometimes more versions of that image because you're starting with RAW and moving to JPEG. But for professional photographers or even higher level hobbyists, definitely shooting in RAW provides a lot more flexibility and can really help improve your photography quite a bit.
Yeah. Thanks, Paul, for calling. Appreciate it very much. I want to give Ruth and Ladysmith a chance to join in. Ruth, hi.
Hi. Thanks a lot for taking my call.
Sure.
I realize this may be not what you're answering today, but I do a lot of photo editing and using the photos for emails and Facebook and all those things. And I'm always confused when I want to make it smaller, which make a file smaller or make the picture smaller so it emails faster. Which thing do I choose, you know, either canvas size or there's something else. I forget what it's called.
So which software are you using?
I'm using Photoshop.
So there are a couple of factors in size. One is the actual physical dimensions or the actual dots that are in that image, the pixels. Mm-hmm. And there's also the number of colors that are available in that pixel, which affects size. And then there's compression. And typically, for example, when you save to a JPEG format, there are different levels of compression that you can apply to a JPEG image that will decrease the actual final file size. So, but at the same time, when you compress an image with JPEG, you're going to introduce some fuzziness and some potentially, if you overcompress, you get something called artifacts. It just kind of looks kind of like a cruddy image. So the best way to make photos smaller, it always depends on how you want to use that image on the other end. So if you were sending an image to me, for example, for me to be able to print it as an 8x10, you would not want to reduce the actual image size too small, because then it may not be, the physical dimensions may not be good enough to print it a physical 8x10 size. So unfortunately, I don't think I have a perfect answer for you. It's based on a variety of factors. If all you're doing is emailing some images to share so somebody can see it on their phone or whatever, then, basically on their computer, and they're not going to print, then you could easily go into image size in Photoshop. What I do is typically change it. It might default to centimeters or something. Change it to pixels. And then I typically don't go any smaller than 1,500 pixels on its longest end, meaning that if it's a portrait image where it's taller than wider, then 1,500 pixels high, and then whatever the and let it automatically fill in the width. And if it's a horizontal landscape type of image, 1,500 pixels wide, and let it do its automatically pick the height.
But that was for emailing, or is that for using it for a more high quality?
That would be for emailing. If I'm using it for high quality, I never resize.
Okay.
I leave it at its original size. Right. I want to get every pixel I can out of that to be able to print. And if it's too large to send by email, then you might want to look at something like Dropbox or Google Drive or other ways to actually, you know, share that file with somebody else, or a flash drive, that kind of thing.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks,
then.
You're welcome.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. And Rick in South Range. Hi, thank you for calling.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you. I have a question about merging photos. My wife and I have often taken two cameras on trips, but generally speaking, we've always had a couple of point-and-shoot Canon cameras. Well, now we've got an iPhone, and we don't find that it very easy to put them into the same folder and then sort by date taken or sort by or arrange them by in order that they were taken. The iPhone pictures go into the folder, of course, and my Canon pictures go into the same folder. Let's say Spring Vacation, we'll title it. But I cannot get them to self-arrange them in the order that they were taken. Do you know any trick to convince the iPhone pictures to do behave better?
You know, this is definitely an interesting problem that I experience myself as well, and
me too.
And I don't quite have a solution at this point. What I typically do now is my iPhone photos, I plug my iPhone into my computer. I do not sync my iPhone with iTunes. What I do is when I plug my iPhone in, it shows as a disk or a drive on the computer. I browse onto my iPhone, and then I select and drag images to the folders that I want them in. So in essence, I'm doing it manually. And that's just because I have not yet found a good solution for this problem.
Well, Mike, thank you very much for your help. When you do find a problem, come back and let us all know.
Yeah, that's for sure. I want to know that too. It's irritating.
Yes, it is.
Very irritating. Carl in Central Mexico. Hi.
Hi there, guys. I got a couple questions here. You're saying you're using at the office TIFF format for long-term archiving. Does it tend to be better for long-term, or is that just your choice?
TIFF has several characteristics that make it, in essence, more stable. One is that it is a recognized international standard, and so
right.
so that for us, if we expect that there will be programs available to read that format, and as long as people write an appropriate TIFF file, we could, you know, somebody could hire somebody to write a program to read that image. So that's good. The other is that TIFF is an uncompressed file format. And what that means is it does not throw any pixels away when it saves the file like JPEG does. So once we've captured that image, whichever way we capture that original image to digital, we know that every one of those pixels will be there once we save it to a file. So it's just a longer-term stable file format, but even today, you know, there's something called a JPEG 2000, and there's other JPEG related image formats that are starting to be talked about as replacing TIFF eventually.
Even if your original isn't TIFF?
Well, so can you give me an example?
Well, whatever my BlackBerry is taking pictures in, or whatever other camera I'm using takes it in, I've just been saving it in generally.
Yeah. So
generally speaking.
So that is really a great example. So for example, if your BlackBerry is using a proprietary file format, I'll just make something up here. Let's just say that BlackBerry had the BlackBerry image format. And if that file format required you to use some special software to view it, from an archival standpoint or a long-term standpoint, we would consider that file to be in jeopardy of not being able to be viewed in the future because that file format is proprietary to BlackBerry. So for us, we might keep that file, but we would create, while we have the software today, we would create a copy of that file in a more standard format, knowing that possibly we wouldn't be able to read that BlackBerry file format in the future. So if your BlackBerry file, your BlackBerry is saving JPEGs normally, then certainly keeping them in their original JPEG format is acceptable. You don't need to convert those to TIFF, because JPEG is an international standard and is pretty stable. What you would not want to do is to open that file and save it again as a JPEG multiple times, because every time you save something as a JPEG, you lose more pixels. And so that's something you would want
to keep in mind.
You'd want to consider that original JPEG your master and only save to something else.
Talking today with Paul Hedges. Great to have him on as we discuss organizing and preserving your digital photos and talking computer software. He'll be with us right up until 12:30 here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us. Computers and all the gadgets that we rely on to connect with the world through the internet have become part of daily life at home and at work. They're great tools. But when they're not working, you can kind of... You're kind of stuck. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Paul Hedges, my guest today, has for many years been the Information Technology Director at Wisconsin Historical Society. His role now is the Emerging Technologies Archivist in the Society's Library and Archives Division, works on digital and audiovisual collections and projects, consults with small businesses, nonprofits, and churches to help them plan for and manage their websites. And Paul, thanks again for spending time with us today. Really appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
We have had many, many good questions. You can certainly join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to have you with us. Maggie from Waupaca has just getting started scanning decades of family photos. Do you have any advice on a best plan of attack for scanning and then organizing?
Wow. My mother, several years ago, decided to do this project herself. And what she did, which I think was extremely helpful, was she essentially organized all of the material physically before she did any scanning. So she planned it. She looked at all the material first and made some decisions. Initially, there were some where she just grouped by date and said these were events that happened in certain years. So she grouped them by that, and then she had a lot of old images and old photos that she had received from family over the years that she grouped by family. But she did all of that work before she did one bit of scanning.
Yeah.
And then she, God love her, she also created a spreadsheet. And every image she wrote a little bit of information about that image. And then in the end, I worked with her to move it to DVDs and we passed it around to all the family. So my recommendation is to look at the material before you do any scanning, if you can. Organize it logically by date and event. Typically, a lot of pictures were taken for specific events. And if you can't do that, then maybe group it by the person or the family. What I would suggest against doing is breaking up event photos into people, meaning if you have a wedding, don't take all those pictures and then say, well, here's a picture of Paul, I'm going to put it in the Paul pile, and here's a picture of Mary and put it in the Mary file. Keep all of those event pictures together, and then scan and pick a file format, pick a scan resolution that you want to scan at, be consistent, and definitely write down for every one of those scans, if you can, who's in that picture, what that is about, because that's...
Haven't we all sat around looking at old photos saying, well, now who's that? And then you run around and try and find it from... We have so many photos. We have no idea who the person is or the people are, and it's so sad.
That's right.
And your mother's a saint for doing
that. She really is. And then what was also really great is that when all of the siblings got together, she handed us all the photos she had scanned and essentially said, now you go ahead and separate this and distribute it however you would like, whoever wants this material. You have the digital. You also now have the prints. You can marry those two together if you'd like. It was a great gift. A great gift.
Wonderful gift. Dick in Cross Plains. I'm sorry, Crest Plains. Thank you for calling. Hi. Dick, are you there? Have we lost him? Where am I? Let's try Nick in Green Bay. Nick, hello. Thanks for calling.
Hi, my quick question is, I was in Texas when the space shuttle, they were moving the space shuttle from wherever to California, and it landed there, and I took pictures with my Android, and I tried to get them printed at Walmart, but they turned out really terrible. And I was wondering if there's any way of actually printing those out so they look good, or am I kind of...
Yeah, it's a good question. I assume the Android pictures you've been able to get them off the phone and put them on your computer?
Yep.
And do you have any sense of what the file size or the dimension, you know, kind of the physical, the pixel dimensions of that image were?
I don't remember because I'm at
work. So typically when pictures do not work well, and what print size were you looking at?
Like a 5x8, just something to put on the wall.
Yeah, sure. And were they blurry? Why were they not good?
They're really blurry. Yeah. I think she tried. I put 5x8, and they tried something like 10x something, and she tried to blow them up way too big.
Okay, so there is ultimately it's just a mathematical calculation. There are only so many pixels in a digital image, and when you try to print that out to get a good quality print, you want to have a certain number of pixels per inch. And so what it sounds like is essentially just the resolution ultimately of that file was too small to be able to be printed in that size. Mm-hmm. So there are, what I'd suggest is maybe search the internet. There are some general kind of tables out there where you can find where it'll say, well, if you have an image that is this many pixels by this many pixels, this is the largest print that you can print without it getting blurry. Give that a try. The other would be if you, typically with Walmart and other places, if you upload an image, often it will tell you once you've uploaded that image whether or not it will work at larger file print sizes or not.
Yeah.
I know Shutterfly does that, but I'm not experienced with Walmart. So you might want to try around.
And thanks again for calling. Let's turn now. I think we have Dick in Cross Plains with us. Dick, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. He was describing capturing information in a spreadsheet for prints. My question is, I have almost 10,000 color transparencies going back into the 1930s from my parents and myself, and on the cardboard holders around the transparencies are already written down the names of the people, the dates, you know, the location or whatever was in the scenery. Is there, I realize I can, you know, scan the slide material itself, the film, but is there some service someplace that can do both at once so I can see the information at the same time I'm seeing the picture without my having to do all the all the spreadsheet stuff and have it two separated, one place and the picture's the other?
Yeah, it's a good question, and certainly if you're interested in going to a service, I would suggest giving some a call and seeing. In my own experience, and I'll say it's somewhat limited, I have done some slide digitizing, is that because slides themselves require light to be, typically when you scan slides, you're having light that's being essentially shown through the slide so that that slide actually can be captured to a digital file, that is different than trying to scan the outer sleeve essentially to be able to get that information. So if I was doing this project on my own today, it would ultimately be a two-scan process. It would be to scan the original slide at the highest resolution I could, and then scanning the slide again, but not as a transparency, but as a regular print. I would suggest calling a vendor, see if there's, you're in Cross Plains, so you could try some of the larger cities and maybe see if there's something or something locally. Definitely, if you want that converted to a spreadsheet, that would require hand editing. Mm-hmm. Somebody would have to really type that into a spreadsheet. It's not going to be automated. But off the top of my head, I think it's a two-scan process. Scan the original transparency and then scan the outside of the sleeve.
There we go. Good luck. Thanks, Nick, for calling. Oh, Kurt from Poinette emailed to say that the April issue of Shutterbug magazine has a recommendation for the RAW conversion. And they say in that article to start with the converter that came with your camera because it's free.
Mm-hmm. And that is an excellent point. There, Canon and Nikon do come with software that does that, and what that will allow you to do is to open those images, apply some basic settings, some basic contrast and brightness and other to those images, and then save them as a JPEG. That is certainly one way to do it, and it is free, definitely.
Luke in Chippewa Falls, hi.
Hi. I tuned in a little late, so hopefully I understand you didn't cover this in depth yet. Maybe you touched on it a little bit. But my question is long-term storage and the media of choice. Now, I do some professional photography. I spend thousands of dollars on cameras and lenses, but I almost devote no money or certainly time to proper storage. So my method is dual copies of DVDs. You know, I have some on flash drives. I'm using some external drives, and they all have, pros and cons, obviously. And I guess what I'm looking for is long-term storage. Now, the file of choice is TIFF or RAW or some uncompressed format for obvious reasons. But those file sizes, like you said, were very big. So you see the dilemma.
I do. So why don't I start with saying how I do it today, and we can talk about the pros and cons of that. So I have a desktop computer with about 1.5 terabytes of storage on it, and I have one one specific folder where all of my images live. And obviously there are subfolders in that, but there's one place on my hard drive where all my images exist. I then also, that folder, I use a cloud backup service. And that cloud backup service, which stores essentially all of those images in the cloud, and it gets updated on a daily basis. I also have two external hard drives. I have one where when my photos go to the cloud, a copy goes to an external hard drive. And then, because I'm a little paranoid, I actually have a little piece of software that copies one external hard drive to another external hard drive. So I ultimately have my files in four locations. Now, I don't consider any of those locations to be long-term storage. They are essentially where all my files are stored, and at some point in the future, I know that I will need to replace one of my hard drives because it will fail, or if my cloud service decides to stop being a cloud service, I know I have it on my external hard drive, and I can then move to a new one. What that means is, as I mentioned earlier, is that my files are always active. They're never someplace that's not.
You put them away and forget about them.
No, they're always. So I do that. I used to do DVDs. I used to do CDs, but what I found is then they sat on a shelf, and then when I went to them maybe 6 years later or 3 years later, I couldn't read from those. And so essentially I've invested in regular hard drive storage and made sure that I copy it in multiple locations and have something off-site. In the case of a fire, I know that there is one external hard drive that has everything on it that has been updated on a daily basis that I can unplug and take with me and know that if everything goes away, I have that hard drive.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Thank you, Luke, for calling. Appreciate it. And I want to give Carol in Cedar Grove a chance to join in. Carol, hi.
Hi. My question is, I have so many negatives, and I was wondering where I can take them to have pictures made or the chemicals to make pictures from them. Because I've done the chemical, and I got all the stuff for chemical doing, but I just don't know where to go to get to all the stuff for it.
So first question is, so you would like to make the photos yourself?
If I could.
And so you'll need photo paper and all the chemicals to do that, and mm-hmm. and of course the time and to do that. You know, I don't have an answer for you on that. I would imagine that there are still photo paper providers out there, though it may be less than it used to be. So. A quick search of the internet, I would imagine, might yeah. help.
Might go online to just put in a local. There are still photography clubs.
Mm-hmm.
I would definitely look into that. I know there's one in Madison,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and probably in the Cedar Grove area there may be one too.
But I would imagine there are still providers of. Paper that you could use, and
just to have them made, you know, just to have them, you know, made commercially would be fine too.
Sure, and so, you know, that's a really great question. I would imagine that there are some a variety of photo printing services that will take your negatives and make prints for you, Yeah, I'd say do another search out there on the internet and see what you find.
Kind of a fun process.
It really is, yeah.
I haven't done it in a long, long time. It used to irritate me that photographers would always talk about the chemistry instead of chemicals.
I never understood why that
was the case, but it sure was a lot of fun to fool around with.
Yeah.
Good luck, Carol. Thank you for calling. Judy in Madison, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I have a question about storage and problems that I've had with memory sticks, where I will start out with either a 2 or 4 gigabyte stick, put photos on it or whatever, and then I will do a quick format when I'm done and want to start over again with that stick. And if I look at the storage space, it's gone from 2 gigabytes down to maybe telling me I only have 500 megabytes. What's happened?
Where'd it go?
Yeah, good question. I don't think I can explain exactly what's happening here, but I've experienced that before, and so typically what I do is follow some basic rules to make sure that I prevent that. One is that once I've taken pictures with that memory card, I take those images off, put it onto my computer, and then I do a full format of that once I know that it is on my computer and backed up in one location. I think it's the full format that is important. The other is that memory sticks, flash drives as well as actual cards, can get confused if you don't eject them or unmount them properly. And so it's always important to make sure that you're actually not just pulling it out of your computer before it's actually done or before doing a full eject, because sometimes it will confuse that. But I would imagine that if you do a full format instead of the other format, that it should solve those problems and make sure to always eject when you're done.
Thank you for calling. Stephanie wonders if you could shed any light on what kind of eco-footprint a typical person's digital library leaves on the planet. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my goodness.
You have to think about the computers.
So, a typical person. So, that's fascinating in many ways, because as we move along into the future, what we're seeing is more and more of our lives are actually stored out in the cloud. And cloud storage is becoming much more cost-effective and cheaper, at least to us as consumers. Certainly, the question of do those data centers that Google and Microsoft, et cetera, are they eco-friendly? That's a great question, and I don't.
That's sure a good one to think about, though, isn't it? I'd love to look into that a little bit, or see if anyone else has.
Yeah, I would say that definitely those questions of hard drives that are failed and then go into the landfill or CDs or DVDs, that we need to look at appropriate ways to actually dispose of those to be as reusable as possible, making sure that we're not putting things that have mercury or other kinds of bad things, into our landfills. Mm-hmm. But that's interesting. I'd have to do a study. I'll look at some studies for that.
Paul, I look forward to your next visit. Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks.
Paul Hedges, our guest today. Emerging Technologies Archivist in the Wisconsin Historical Society's Library and Archives Division.